16 to 1, a podcast about education, teaching, and learning. Hello.
Hey.
Welcome.
Welcome, welcome.
To episode 11.
Maslow's hierarchy.
I'm excited. I like this topic.
It's near and dear to my heart.
Is it?
It is. For reasons I will explain.
Maslow is close to anybody's heart.
It's very close to my heart.
Okay. Well,
my heart is weird
and full of Maslow.
No, not full, but I mean, well, we'll get there. Anyway, what are we drinking?
Well, a lot of water.
Yeah.
To stay hydrated. It's been very hot in Ohio for Memorial Day weekend.
Very warm day. We're also drinking summer shandies,
which is finally out, which means it's really summer.
Summer has officially arrived. It really is, isn't it?
And you only know it when this shows up in Kroger.
Yep.
So here we are.
Line and Kugel.
School is out.
It is.
Officially.
You're done, right? You're done.
I am done. Grades are not due for a couple more days, but... That's
Have
fine.
You submitted yours?
I did, but you just always, you know, you're not really done till like that part is settled.
Right. I was going to rat you out if you hadn't submitted.
No, I have. Please don't, though, yell. No, they won't yell, but they do need their grades in. Weird year.
Yeah, weird year for everyone.
Emotional.
Emotional
Very
roller coaster.
Emotional. We had our like last staff meeting and it was like kind of tough.
Well, also your principal retired.
My principal is retiring. Yeah.
And it had to kind of happen over Zoom. So that was kind of
Yeah, and nobody deserves that after a career in education. Like you all deserve a you know, a celebration.
A cake.
At least.
And some cards.
Minimum. Yeah. So
and in person weeping.
Because it's not, you know, you can't really like pay homage to someone in that way.
Absolutely.
So it doesn't feel over because it doesn't feel new yet, but give it time.
Right. Well, okay, so on to other life things.
Yeah.
It's Memorial Day, and we are recording, and we have spent our Memorial Day being outside, as one should. We both have sunburns. We both hurt so much that we can barely move. We lugged a bunch of rocks around. We mulched.
We did.
We power washed an area, the square footage equivalent of Vermont, I think. It was
Vermont.
It was a big day for us in the houseworking kind of world. But yeah, we got that we got the other raised bed that we talked about last time. We got the other one finally done.
We mulched. We moved pavers. We moved stones.
Yeah, there was a lot of chucking stones to and fro. Big ones.
I hurt.
Yep. That's what we did today.
I can barely sit here. I had to like will myself to sit upright for this episode.
It's been a little bit rough. Being upright is not fun.
No.
But we are dedicated and we are here to bring you everything you ever wanted to know or didn't know you needed to know.
One more time.
You
for the people in the back.
You know, I said what
did
I
you,
said.
Would you? How about some Maslow?
I said what I said. I'm sticking to it. Okay, so
can't
what?
Can't wait for you to try to edit that.
No,
monster.
No, we're not going to do that. What is Maslow's hierarchy? Let's talk about this.
Well,
a little bit.
How were you introduced to it?
In middle school, I took a really cool class with one of my favorite teachers of all time, and it was a gifted class, which they kind of don't exist anymore. But for me, it was a very important part of my social development in middle school. And I would say it's probably the same for many of my peers who were in those classes. It was a bunch of kind of nerdy people getting together, and our teacher motivated us in all kinds of strange and weird ways. But she is the one who introduced me and many of my friends to Maslow's hierarchy. And we had a lot of very animated discussion about it, especially for obnoxious middle school kids, you can imagine. But that is how I first heard about it. And then I continued to hear about it in sort of some of my educational theory courses in graduate school. Not so much as a true and good thing, please follow it, more as just like an interesting and useful theory and approach to education. So how did you hear about it?
Not till college. Probably like Ed 110 or whatever intro, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Psychology? Is that what you're... Intro to education.
Intro to ed.
Oh, 110. Okay. So you learned about it in education context too.
Yeah. And I mean, we had to take a lot of psych classes as part of an ed major anyways. So I definitely did. I took like an adolescent psychology class. And so we talked about it a lot there, but that wasn't until like my third year of school.
Mm-hmm.
So like my first year, I would have heard about it in education class. And then obviously in every education class ever, it's brought up. It's like, you know, important stuff.
Yeah.
So it's constantly talked about and reflected on. And so it's something I feel pretty comfortable
with. So what is it? Just, you know, elevator pitch. What is Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
It is a theory of human motivation. So it's the belief that if humans are able to fulfill themselves in all of these ways, then they can achieve, which is the greatest thing, which is self-actualization. But it's built up in a way that you have to keep achieving from the bottom up in order to earn it, essentially, or to, you know,
it's kind of a theory. It's sort of a theory of self and of motivation at the same time. It's sort of talking about what keeps your psyche together, held together, the glue that kind of makes you function the way that you should be functioning. But yeah, we talk about it often in a context of motivation, which was kind of what he was about. So it gets talked about in education a lot because we want to not only motivate our students, but also help we want to understand what might be prohibiting them from being motivated, which might have nothing to do with anything school in the classroom, right? So that's why it's a kind of important part of educational psychology.
Yeah. And I mean, it's something that teachers have to be thinking about, even without like being like, oh, am I assessing Maslow's? Like, you're doing it, but you're not always thinking in terms of like, okay, if a kid is doing this, like what's going on at home? Or you like, you're always kind of looking for that underlying reason for whatever the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
And every single one can come back to Maslow's in some sort of way.
Right.
So it's constant.
Right.
For educators and for students and, I mean, for people, obviously, but most people aren't thinking about it in like a day-to-day sort of.
Well, it's a way to make us all more aware of how effort and motivation work in the context of the rest of the unseen lives of students. So, yeah, it's just what you're saying.
I think it's interesting how you're already talking about the effort and motivation of it, because a lot of how I was taught Maslow's is that for many kids, it's out of their control. So it's not actually a reflection of their effort or something like that, but it's a byproduct of what home is like, or you know what I mean? So, I mean, there's obviously effort involved, but it's really interesting to hear you talk about it that way, because in my head, so many of the factors of Maslow's are not in their control to make a decision of. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
I mean, we're going to get into that, obviously, sure. But I like that phrasing because I'm always sort of tackling Maslow's in a way that, like, my kids have less control over it than I think they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they do have some, obviously, but it's just an interesting phrase. That's all.
Well, I think I probably should have been a little more careful about that because I didn't mean to suggest that these things are in our control. Many of them aren't. And we'll talk about the specific things in the hierarchy, but the path to self-actualization is full of a lot of things that we cannot have any control over.
There are some decisions involved. Like, I'm not being dismissive. I more just meant that you're dealt what you're dealt for students. Mm-hmm. And so, like, some of these lower level things might not be provided, but like, they still have the option to overcome. You know, we'll get there.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean.
Well, let's start talking through these levels.
Very bottom.
Yeah, the very bottom of this thing is usually visualized as a pyramid. And on the very bottom level, these are the most basic needs. He breaks them up into basic needs, psychological needs, and self-fulfillment needs. So we're in the basic needs realm right now. The very, very first level, what's on that one?
Food, water, warmth, and rest. And we've seen this one come up a lot recently because of schools being out for coronavirus. Because there's been a lot of push for like, how will they get fed and that kind of stuff, because so many kids rely on free and reduced lunches or even just, you know, a place to be during the day while whoever is at home works. This has been really relevant because every school that I know of has been preparing some type of meals for students to pick up to help, you know what I mean, kind of bridge the gap as far as maybe what whoever at home can afford and ease and availability.
This is one that's a little bit difficult to get the public to raise to the level of public consciousness, because most average Facebook warriors aren't thinking of schools as a place that meet these basic physiological needs of like food and water and warmth and rest and things like that. We don't.
I mean, one of the trainings we have to do every year is about the homeless population and how we service them. And so those are the kids that immediately come to my mind when we're dealing with physiological, because those are the kids who we might be doing their laundry while at school. You know what I mean? Like those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just the homeless students, obviously, but it's, you know, students who are affected in those ways that are, you know, that need that level. But schools do provide a warm place to be. We have food. You know what I mean? Like we have shelter. They have, which like safety's next. But schools just by definition and just being that building are providing a lot of that first level for kids.
Right. We also have to think of, I mean, there are kind of proactive providing for these needs kind of instances, but then they're also reacting to what you see your students doing and thinking about those instances. So if a student is falling asleep in class, it might not be because they're not motivated or they don't want to be in your class or something like that. It might be because...
It's not personal.
Right. It might be because they were shuttled back and forth between mom and dad's house or something happened and
or they're working two jobs or
Or their parents are working two jobs and they have to be... Or they're, you know, they're kid sister's primary caregiver during, you know, whatever it is. There are all kinds of reasons why kids might not be totally present mentally in your class. And it's just... You got to keep that kind of stuff in mind and not just assume it's because somebody's lazy or unwilling.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
It's just, but those are the things people don't think about.
Yep.
And most of the people that, I mean, these warrior, you know, keyboard warriors, these are people who are probably very, very only slightly affected by these kinds of things ever in their lives. They've been very privileged, which is a great, you know, thing for them. But most of the people that I hear make comments about why I would let a kid sleep in my class. They've never even had to think about, you know, what that might have been.
Why a kid might be sleeping in their class.
Yeah, like they've never done what my kids have done, so.
Right. Okay, let's go.
Next level.
Yeah.
We just build, like, really easily, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So the next one is security and safety.
Yeah, safety needs.
I kind of already mentioned it, just by, like, being a place to, you know, to be cared for in a lot of ways for students. But... like on top of that, like literally safety, like, I mean, we do active shooter drills, we have fire drills, we have tornado drills. So there's a lot of that type of security, I guess I would say, because students know, okay, if this happens, my teacher's going to do this to make sure we're as safe, you know, that kind of thing. So it comes in that way. The other thing that I like about this point, sorry to just keep talking if you want to jump in, have at it, but the other thing that I see as, like, security and safety is, like, just showing up for kids. And, like, I keep talking as a high school teacher because that's all I've ever done. But I was in a car wreck last year and I missed quite a bit of school. And it was really interesting, the kids who came up and told me that they were worried about me and had been upset because I wasn't there. And they weren't kids that I was, like, super close with. Like, I maybe had only had them for that year. But those are the kids that I kind of figured out were the ones who needed, you know what I mean? Like, me there every day. The security of their teacher being in the room, doing the thing that they do, that's security and safety for some kids, because we might be the only people who are reliably wherever. And so I think it's much bigger than just...
You're talking about kind of psychological safety.
Yeah, like they can come into my room.
Physical one.
Yeah, they're going to come into my room and they know that they can say what they want within reason and that I'll support them. You know what I mean? Like, it's a safe place. Classrooms are safe places for kids in a bunch of ways. But I think that this one is maybe even one of the most important in a classroom, because if they don't feel these things, then they're not they're not going to learn.
Yeah. And just, I mean, that's kind of the important thing about a lot of these, is that the absence of them is what really can get in the way of what we might consider to be a typical classroom experience a lot of times. That's why this gets brought up in educational context. It's what's missing that is preventing you know, my classroom time from being as effective as it could be.
And I think that's also one of the things that, like, hangs over teachers' heads, like, when they take days off if they're sick or whatever, because you know that for some kids, like, that's as reliable as it gets for them. That's never an easy thing to, like, to be able to put yourself above. But it's also, like, a huge reflection of what teachers are providing for students in ways that a lot of people in the public and communities and families don't always see. Is
right,
that,
right.
You know, a kid notices if I am late into whatever, you know, like that kind of
thing. Like when I was working I was working in an office in Baltimore doing some, you know, coding types work, and I wouldn't say that I ever thought that if I missed a day of work because I was sick that somebody would have their psychological needs unmet, right?
Not be.
But I mean, and it, I mean, maybe it was true, I don't know, but probably not. I'm gonna guess probably not. And that's, this is unique to education.
It is.
I think this teacher as the one who meets oftentimes unmet psychological needs of students in the day-to-day. So,
all right, level three, your turn.
Oh boy. Belongingness and love needs, intimate relationships and friends. Yeah, so this was a funny one to talk about in middle school, as you can imagine, because everyone freaked out that sex was a thing that was required to be happy. And, well, of course, all middle school kids were like, well, then I'm never going to be happy, obviously, because we don't have sex. But and actually, the placement of sex on the pyramid at this level is one of the more hotly contested things about Maslow's hierarchy. One of the criticisms of it is that people are not so keen on the idea of putting sex where it is in the pyramid of self-actualization because they don't think it's quite that necessary.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wasn't sure where you're going to go, and I wasn't expecting that one, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's the lower end of the psychological needs part of the pyramid.
Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense to me to think of it more generally as intimacy and friendship.
Yeah, I've never taken it as literal as actual sex. Well, that's for sure.
Maslow does, but he obviously...
Yes, but in the education class, it's not really where we're going.
In education
classes,
not so much.
Like, the goal is not to be like, so your kids need to have sex.
No, that is not the
to
goal.
To do great on this whatever test.
No,
like,
no.
That's not...
Just to be clear, not really what we're talking about in
not at all what we're talking about, to be clear.
Well, I mean, I think we can see a lot of this coming out in middle school, especially, is a time when this third one is really difficult for a lot of kids. Having friendships and like really close relationships in middle school is just next to impossible for a lot of people to do for a lot of weird social reasons. I mean, I was a kid who struggled with friends in middle school. I had a whole bunch of friends in elementary school. Then I had no friends in middle school, and then I finally found my tribe again in high school. But it was, there were some lost years in there where that need was not really being fulfilled in the best way possible. I have personal experience with what it feels like to not have that particular need met, but I think that's probably true of a lot of middle schoolers. So yeah. I don't claim
high
to.
High schoolers too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah.
hard for a lot of them to find, you know, their fit.
And it can be all-consuming to feel like you're on the outside looking in of friend groups or friendships or whatever it is. It can really just take over your entire mind.
Yeah, it can. And I also see it in, like, kids who are having problems with their friends. It's like, you know, I mean, I've seen some kids, it seems like... When they go through struggles with friendships, it's almost worse than a breakup sometimes.
Right.
Like, so, yeah, I can, for sure, in middle school, because I think everybody had a weird middle school experience anyways. So, but even still in high school, we see those things, you know, coming into play.
Yep. Okay. Fourth level, esteem needs.
These are kind of running together. This one doesn't feel as different from self-actualization at times.
Yeah. So what are esteem needs?
It's basically like feelings of accomplishment.
So we were kind of trying to talk about, and I agree that this one gets a little bit, the lines get a little bit blurry for me between feeling like you've accomplished something and self-actualization. But I guess we'll talk a little more about the specifics of self-actualization. But feeling like you have accomplished something at the end of a day's
whatever
work,
it is, yeah.
It is an important need, like feeling like you didn't just waste a day, which is a feeling that we as adults sometimes can have, but it's not the most fun when you have those kinds of days where you're like, man, I just didn't do anything today and I needed to accomplish so much and now I'm crushed by it. So that's very
adulthood
possible.
In the nutshell,
I think. Adulthood is a lot like that a lot of the time. But we were talking about how grading and feedback and opportunities to feel proud of your own work as a student probably have a lot to do with this level. Kind of interested in how grading does or doesn't contribute to this level.
Yeah.
Maybe grading does not promote feelings of accomplishment.
I don't think it always does, but that's also because students are so wrapped up in what that reflects rather than like the
right
the journey, you know. I not to get like
see I mean, for, as somebody who was obsessed with getting good grades in high school, I wouldn't say that I ever had a feeling of accomplishment when I got an A. It's more just like, this is my expectation for myself, and if I don't get an A, then I'm doing horribly, and I am upset. So the getting the grade, even if it's a good thing to try to get good grades, I'm not sure that that is really what promotes these feelings of accomplishment that we're talking about here.
No, because kids don't, my students don't normally value like the learning it took to get there. Like, if that makes sense, it's more just like, oh, good, I got an A. That's what mom and, you know, whoever at home and what I expect. And so, yes, this is fine. But, like, if you were to talk about, well, how great is it that we got there by this? Or, you know, whatever this stuff was, that's not nearly as important. Yeah. Even though they're learning valuable skills to help excel in other places, like, it's not top priority.
No, I think it's interesting for teachers to be aware of the difference there, that giving a grade is not necessarily the thing that promotes a true feeling of accomplishment. So other forms of feedback, and like you were talking about, looking at, well, look at all of these things that we accomplished, who, you know, forget about the grade for a second, but this is what you did. You can be proud of this work that got you here,
and now you can do these things because you know this thing,
right?
Like, it's never,
and feedback that isn't a grade,
yeah,
also kind of an important piece of this,
right?
This prestige puzzle.
I found this to be really true. I teach a composition class through a local university, and I found it that when I did rough drafts with my kids, I would make, at first I wasn't making a lot of comments. I was giving some. And then on the final draft, when they submitted it, I'd do like pages of, you know, comments and thoughts and things. And it wasn't really doing anything for them. And then I switched it. And so on the rough drafts, I started like doing all kinds of things like to kind of help guide, you know, and then they took those more to heart because then it was going to lead them to what they thought would be a better grade. Does that make sense? So the feedback at the end wasn't as important as the feedback before the final submission.
Right.
Because it didn't affect any, you know, the first time it was just like, oh, well, she wrote this, and it didn't do anything different for them. It wasn't like they took that and were like, next time I'll.
Right.
But if you did it during the rough draft, they would almost always make those changes because they knew, you know what I mean? Like, they're smart. I mean, they know. They want to get the grade. It's just, and we're all that way. I mean, right, like, this is true in, like, everything, but if you're given the option to know, okay, if I have a 95% and I don't do this and I have a 94%, I'm going to, a lot of kids are not going to do it because it's not going to that drastically change their grade.
Right.
In any way that actually implies a, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think one of the most valuable experiences for me in my academic career was when I wrote my senior paper in college. Everybody has to write a senior essay, and you have an advisor. Like, it's kind of like a thesis advisor at the undergraduate level. But this is, at that point, it's like a, you work on it all year long, but you also have a month off of your regular classes to just write and meet with your advisor. And it's this really long and interesting and difficult period of mashing your words around until they're better and better, and finally, like, you know, worthy of being turned in and reviewed so that you can graduate. But it's, there's a lot of feedback and a lot of back and forth, and it's really rewarding at the end. You feel like you really did something. We don't really have grades at my college, so even better, it wasn't like the whole point of it was to be rewarded by a grade. It was really in the process of getting there. So I really value that kind of non-grade-based feedback and, you know, working together, teacher and students working together to deepen learning like that. It's just,
sure,
it's really difficult to find time to do that in, like, public school setting.
It so sounds nice, but I'm not recommending
not recommending that you do that.
I don't think I could, so that's good.
So, but I just, it's just a totally different take on what progress looks like and what being proud of an accomplishment feels like. You just totally own this thing, you know. So
that'd be very fulfilling.
Yeah. Let's talk about self-actualization. Are we there yet?
Five.
Have we achieved it?
The tippy top.
Have we self-actualized?
I don't know. Okay, so this basically means that you fulfilled your own talent, right? Like, You're using your full potential. It's independent and spontaneous. Like, you are fulfilling tasks beyond yourself and for a greater good. So it's like just an extreme level of accomplishment in my head. And so I was telling, when we were coming up with the notes for this, I was saying that self-actualization in the classroom is like the one period where a lesson you weren't like super confident in just like kills it. Like, the kids love it. They're into it. It's the best thing you've ever done. You're like meant for this, right? In your head, you're like, oh, I can totally do this. And then the next period, it's not that anymore. And the kids hate it and they won't participate. So the moment of self-actualization is beautiful and it's perfect, but it's very short-lived in my head, at least.
Yeah, we were talking about whether or not we can actually get to this point, or if we do, how, what does it look like? For me, I think being in super creative mode is what it looks like when I'm writing a piece of music, or when I'm, you know, doing some crazy coding stuff that's new to me but feels really good when I get to the end of it. Those things kind of feel that way. It's kind of like when you get into that flow state, maybe, is when you're close to self-actualization. Although for Maslow, he does, like you mentioned, there's this kind of aspect of maybe doing work for something beyond oneself or for other people, like sort of a greater good kind of work. You're matching your full talents and potential to the work that you're doing.
And doing it for others that benefits them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. These people who get to this level also are kind of socially compassionate, but maybe they have a few really good friends instead of a whole bunch of acquaintances.
I think this one is kind of exciting because every kid will do it differently.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it'll look different every single time it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a light bulb moment, but it's a million different ways. You know what I mean? So I think that's sort of interesting about it. And so, like, when you were talking about yours, like, my self-actualization probably wouldn't look like that. Like, it wouldn't be.
Sure.
But I think that's what's cool.
Talents and interests and all that are different.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So I think that's what's kind of neat about it, is that the maps are similar, right? Like, the the experience to get there, we have to fulfill these things similarly. But once you get to the top, it's completely independent and unique.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I was also mentioning that one day you've got 1 through 4 covered and the next day you're at number one. You know what I mean? Like, you're not always in the same place, like from day to day, from moment to moment, from class to class, like you're fluctuating.
Mm-hmm.
There's just.
And your kids are too.
Yeah.
Right. Students are probably all over the place on this hierarchy. I mean,
tell me about it.
From moment to moment in any given day.
It's like question to question. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So is it true? Is this possible? Does it make sense? Is it reasonable?
So I think we could test whether or not the theory is true. And some of what you have been talking about is seeing the ways in which these things can be true in your classroom, especially that it is in fact true that some of these basic needs and psychological needs aren't being met for your kids.
Lower tier things.
You're sure they're not getting to this higher tier of self-actualization. It's really pretty obvious.
Well, and that changes your teaching in so many ways, right? Because then you have an entire classroom, or however you do it, you know, every period for me, of kids who are at all different levels, who do and don't have all kinds of things. And so it's very hard, like, you know, if we were to use all the teacher vocab, it would just be like individualized learning. And that's the push, right? To make sure that we're servicing every student as needed based on their learning abilities. But when you start putting these things in, it's like, well, is them being here and having food enough to fulfill that so that we can move on to make sure that who I'm sitting them with is someone that they're comfortable with and that they can be productive around? You know, like, there's all of these little parts of it that are just so difficult to nail for every kid, every period, every day.
That's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
But I do think there's at least some evidence, like I was saying, there's some evidence that some parts of this theory, if not true, then maybe at least useful for the classroom.
I agree. Oh, yeah.
So I do want to talk a little bit about some of the other criticisms of this. Maslow researched what he was calling exemplary people from the past, such as Albert Einstein, Eleanor Roosevelt, and elite college students. So he studied, I think I read, the top 1% of college achievers at the time, or whatever
those
it was.
Guinea pigs.
Right, to form this particular hierarchy. So, you know, it's a hierarchy for neurotypical, able-bodied people.
Yeah.
And
Which is kind of the problem.
Yeah. It is a problem.
I think it's a neat way to assess these things. It doesn't seem the most encompassing, maybe? You know,
yeah,
I mean?
One can...
Reflective?
You gotta wonder how universal it can be if you leave out even bothering to study people who are different from these.
Sure.
You know, because you're already selected what you think is the top right. of self-actualization for everyone at that point. You've yes. already... There's this confirmation bias because you've already said, well, I think it's these people. And then your whole study is set up around
these
people. How do these people,
yeah.
and only these people, right. what this is the top of their pyramid is self-actualization.
Like, is it fair to assess my students based on whatever Eleanor Roosevelt fulfilled at each level? Like,
yeah.
I like that as a, you
there's,
know.
Yeah, there's another criticism that is kind of about the ethnocentricity of this thing, which I find interesting, and in, maybe not quite so much in high school that you would see it, or at least the one that you teach in, but at the college level, this can come into play a lot with international students.
Yeah.
This criticism of, well, okay, this seems to be a hierarchy geared toward an highly individualistic society.
Yeah.
So, you know, America, we are very driven by individualism and
sure.
the self, and I'm going to do what I can do because I have the freedom to do it.
And that's not the case everywhere.
Yeah, there are collectivist societies where the greater good is more defined by a social fabric than by individual achievement. And not even the greater good, but, you know, rules and morals
sure.
and fabrics of culture are more defined by collectivist attitudes than by individualistic ones. And this hierarchy seems to not be quite so compatible with those
yeah.
kinds of societies. So
yeah,
there are a whole bunch of things where just not studied as a part of this thing that is claiming to be a hierarchy for fulfillment for all kinds of humans.
Maybe his point is just that it is so universal. Like, we are human enough
mm-hmm.
to make it work.
Well, that's the claim.
Regardless of.
That
yeah.
is the claim. And I do think that... I think
there's
it's
some
right.
possible truth to that.
Well, I think it's easier for the basic needs.
Yeah,
it's
I agree.
It's easier to say everyone needs this because we kind of all, regardless of ability or background or what kind of society we live in or whatever, we all kind of basically agree that not starving is a good thing,
right?
You know, having shelter is
yes.
a good thing. So those things are much less controversial.
No,
where,
I agree.
Where it gets much trickier is in the higher ups on this
sure.
hierarchy and where you position things like
yeah.
friendship or
yeah. relationships,
self-actualization. Yeah,
sure.
Sometimes maybe relationships are way more important than me doing some work that contributes to a nebulous
yes.
idea of a greater good. Maybe it's actually I'm fulfilling myself the most when I'm engaging in a good friendship.
Right.
Maybe that's true. Maybe
that's your peak.
Yeah, maybe the positions on the hierarchy aren't quite right for everyone.
Yeah.
So those are some...
That's an interesting point. I don't disagree with it. I even wrote, like, is it possible to achieve self-actualization? Like, that's a real question I've always wondered in my learning of it. And then, the attempt to teach it. If you're there, what is it like? How long?
Mm-hmm.
Like, all of those things. And so it doesn't make me discredited enough to believe that it's not helpful in the classroom. But it does make you wonder, like, okay, what is this stuff at the top? And, like, where... I don't know. Where does it fall for everyone, I guess?
Do you teach your kids about this?
I do. Not this year, unfortunately. Ugh, a lot of things I didn't get to this year.
Right.
But that's okay. Years past, one of my favorite pieces to teach is The Crucible by Arthur Miller, which is a story of the Salem Witch Trials in Salem, Massachusetts. And it is also a thinly veiled reference to the Red Scare of communism in America. And so Abigail Williams is one of the young ladies involved in the story. And I don't want to give away, but probably everyone knows it anyways. But she's the center of every problem. She's 16 and she's living with her uncle, and she just doesn't have the ability to make proper decisions or, you know, reasonable decisions. And so I teach Maslow to my students as a way then for us to understand Abigail Williams' character better. So I say, okay, when she says this, like, if we had to put this somewhere based on what we think we know of Abigail, like, which part of Maslow's is this fulfilling or not fulfilling for her? And so in doing that, though, it makes a really cool connection for them to start thinking about themselves. So what's happening mm-hmm. in my home, in my classroom, in my whatever, that's affecting me? And, you know, it's a little hard to compare it to the witch trials, but, like, their teenager is well enough that they can understand that this teenager is making some very, you know, poor choices. And so the kids, I think they like it when they get to do it that way, because then it's not just about them, right? Like, it's very hard to put yourself into this Maslow's hierarchy, especially as a teenager. It'd be very difficult. And some kids wouldn't be comfortable doing it. But to do it to this character makes it much more reasonable for them, because then they can say, all right, Abigail, I think just achieved this.
Mm-hmm.
So now we need to be looking for what this one looks like. And so then they're, and they read much deeper than into the, her, you know, specifically in the scenes where she is, because they're looking for her to keep achieving. And so the end is like, does she achieve it? Like, and that's part of the discussion. And it's a cool way to cover it. And it could, I mean, geez, you could do this with any character, you know, but it is kind of a cool way to cover it. And it's an interesting couple of days. That's for sure.
Sure.
But I like teaching it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I found it very valuable to learn about it, even as a middle schooler, though it was a bit intense and overwhelming to learn about this.
Well, and in The Crucible, the sex factor is one of them. Right. Like, that's something we have to talk about. So, like, wherever it does fit on, you know, the hierarchy, you know, that's part of the conversation with her. And so it's really interesting.
Well, I think even maybe as middle schoolers, because we didn't believe sex was a possible thing that would ever happen to any of us.
No chance.
It was almost like... some of the, like, the two higher ones were even more troubling for us, like feelings of accomplishment.
You think,
and
you thought you'd never get there.
Well, right. Feelings of accomplishment and self-actualization, those were more troubling for a sort of tormented middle school nerd. With no friends. than some of these other things were. And obviously, like you mentioned, we were all in, well, maybe not all, but most of us were in positions of relative privilege and comfort. So
yeah, I mean,
a lot of these
my
things,
story is that. So
right,
yes.
Right. Well, a lot of these things for us when we talked about that were a little bit like, yeah, whatever. But we really, we kind of, through discussions of all these things, we had our eyes open to the fact that, hey, maybe not everyone in this room experiences some of these basic needs in the same way that some of us do. So that was another eye-opening thing about studying it even that young, was that it made us aware.
I mean, as a teacher, I think you have to be thinking about these things, and you are, and you might not know it, you don't think of it that way, but like, it's part of your prep. It's part of your lesson
you're
planning.
Not necessarily going through a mental checklist of Maslow's hierarchy every time you're preparing a lesson plan, but it is kind of this constant low grade thing that you keep in mind when you're working with other people.
And I think you have to, and I think it's true in every job and every corner. You know what I mean? Like, you, your coworkers, you have to think about how you treat them. But, you know, all types of things. So it's applicable to everyone. We're all on it somewhere. It's up to you. I mean, where you think you are currently, but...
I might be on the bottom currently. But the way my body feels, I don't feel like my basic needs are being
you're not being
met
fulfilled
very
by
well
your body right now.
Because I don't know.
Everything hurts.
I need rest. That's what
I
need.
That's where I am.
The bottom
well
one on the hierarchy.
All right. So last week.
Fill in the blank.
Fill in the blank.
Yeah.
Was how much money did 16-year-old Fortnite player Booga win in the inaugural Fortnite World Cup in 2019? This was part of our esports discussion. And he won $3 million as a 16-year-old to play video games.
A 16-year-old gamer.
That's what he
won. $3 million.
Yeah, and he's still in school. Whatever. So that was pretty cool. And good for him, you know. He's finding a way to do it all.
It's quite a grind for a 16-year-old, but quite a prize for a 16-year-old also. Yeah. So to anyone who thinks there's no future in gaming, just keep that in mind when your kids express an interest.
Honestly.
It takes a lot of practice and skill to get to that level where Booga is. But
he's self-actualizing up there.
Self-actualizing esports.
Yes. Okay, so this week, what's our question? What's our fill in the blank?
That's... So we're recording on Memorial Day, like we said. So this year we're asking, in what year was Memorial Day declared a national holiday by Congress?
Formally, is like the formal. It had been happening.
So this is mostly for our...
Congress, finally.
Right.
Yes.
It's mostly for our United States listeners, but we are asking when United States Congress...
Yeah.
What year did they
this
declare
is a big day for
Memorial
America.
Day
Memorial
a national holiday?
A big one, so... Okay. What did we learn in these 2 weeks? Did you learn anything? You did.
I learned how to use a bunch of different power tools. Today I used 2 saws, a drill, and a power washer.
Oh, the power washer. What a champion.
Which I learned how to use. I didn't really know, but your dad thankfully came over and taught us how to use this thing. But It's a beast, and it was a long day of scrubbing concrete, and now I have a farmer's tan.
You do, and you have a redneck.
I have a redneck, and I deserve it because I did not put on sunscreen, but now I will. It only takes about once per year of me getting a sunburn before I always remember to put on the sunscreen.
You're very eager to do it.
But yeah, I was playing with the circular saw, and then I played with the jigsaw. This is to make the other of the two garden beds that we had in back. And then we mulched and put stones around it, and now here we are.
And you dropped a
in
old,
great pain.
Big old thing on your toe?
I dropped a 2x6 on my toe. I hurt my toe. Okay, here's the thing
that
I learned.
That was like hour one of
here's
the
what
work
I learned.
Also, so I thought it was over for the day.
Let me reframe what I learned. Listen when they tell you in shop and in chemistry classes in high school to not wear open-toed shoes. Listen to them.
Yeah.
Because I was wearing sandals and I should not have been. And nope. I dropped a 2x6 on my toe.
I asked her if she wanted any feedback and she really didn't.
I did not want feedback on that situation. I should have worn closed-toed shoes. Also, maybe steel-toed boots. But at
that
least.
That was a real outfit for you.
At the very least, closed-toed shoes. So do
that's
that.
That's what you learned.
That's what I learned.
Wear boots.
Yep. All right. What did you learn?
It was just a cool moment. It wasn't necessarily learning. Okay, so the podcast that got me into podcasts years ago, I'm in a couple of their groups online, and one of them was on there, in one of these groups, there was a discussion thread, a question about, they were looking for recommendations of podcasts about education. And so I, of course, was just trying to, you know, promo us a little bit. Because we're in a pretty small category.
As you do.
And I was like, I was typing out our website. I was just going to just hit send, post it there. Maybe someone will click and whatever. And when I submitted it, someone above me had already commented our podcast. And I think I cried on the couch because it hadn't happened to us before. It had not happened.
It's really sweet to see your thing in the wild and somebody talking about it for the first time. It's
and they weren't
deal.
Bashing us, which was so great.
No, they weren't mad.
Because you never know.
They weren't mad at all.
No, they weren't mad at all. And they were promoting us. And it was just a really cool moment because it was one of those that I was like, yes, this is, people are enjoying it. And so to the teacher Renos out there who are listening, thank you. And please keep supporting our podcast, everyone, sharing it, whatever.
Yeah. We really appreciate the support.
We do.
It's
and
very
it's
cool
been
to
a
see.
Lot of fun.
It's very rewarding.
It is. And
that,
it's just something I enjoy.
Feeling of accomplishment when we talk about on the hierarchy.
Ooh, yeah. We can Maslow's this if you
I
want.
I can self-actualize now.
Hey, here I go. Here we go, actually. It's over. Anything
it?
Else?
I think that's it. I think that's a wrap.
See you next time.
Bye. Listeners, thanks for supporting 16 to 1.
We're trying to grow our audience, so please check us out at 16to1.com, all spelled out, and tell your friends about the show.
On our website, you can find links to follow us on social media, an archive of all our old episodes, and a contact form where you can get in touch.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next show.